Accession number 18614, Real 2.
Jack Holness, Real 2.
They asked for these volunteers, but bearing in mind Christmas leave was coming up, no one wanted to volunteer. So the signal sergeant said at that time, well, if no one volunteers, I'm afraid someone will have to be pulled out to go. He gave it two more days, came back in again. Is anybody ready to volunteer? Not a sound. He said, well, I'm afraid I've got to detail the two. And he said, if they want two young signalers urgent, the only two we can send are the two from the top of the squad. So that turned out to be me and a lad called Jeff Harms, who sadly was killed at Salerno. I have a photograph of his grave, actually, at Salerno. And we were told that the following week we would have the exam. The two of us decided that now we'd already been detailed for this draft for the third, that our exam wouldn't mean much to us. We could do what was necessary. We went into the classroom for the examination along with everybody else. We sat opposite each other. We did what so many kids do in the early stages in school. We cribbed from each other. And we thought, we'll get this over as quick as we can, because we knew we were going to go off on embarkation leave immediately after the exam. We got through the written exam in 1 hour, and I think it lasted normally about three. We raced through it. We were then ushered into headquarter company office, or signal platoon office, whichever, where the captain, Rose Signals, was. And blah, 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 you've passed your exam. Well, of course, we'd passed it all through the course. They knew we could do it, so it was a bit of a shambles was the exam on our part, and he presented us with our cross flags. We'd passed our course. We were then paid, ration cards, kit ready, and off we went home. Now, this was just before Christmas, a week before, if I can remember. And
1941.
Yes, and we were given to understand that no military were allowed to travel over the actual Christmas holiday, which was Christmas Eve, Christmas Day, what have you, unless very urgent. It was to be left, the trains had to be left for civilian people travelling to and fro, so no military personnel would travel as normal on leave, except for people like us who were on draft. So my leave was up on Christmas Eve 1941. I travelled back to Pirbright on Christmas Eve 1941. You can well understand how I felt leaving the family Christmas Eve. And I arrived at Brookwood Station at probably somewhere about 8 in the evening. Full marching order. Went straight into the pub, Brookwood. There were a number of guardsmen in there, staff people from Pirbright, older guardsmen. And it was crowded, trying to get a drink, and I didn't drink much. I used to drink pint shandies in those days. And one of the old sweats, I'll call him, saw me, and full great court order and all the gear, and he just passed over a pint of ale and he said, get that down, son. He said, your need's greater than mine. And he said, then get down the road, because you had to walk how far? Mile and a half, three miles down to the camp from Brookwood. So off I went. And feeling as I did, lump in the throat about Christmas and all the rest of it, and that's it, I'm on my way. I had Christmas dinner along with the rest the next day at Pairbright. And then along with my pal Jeff Harms, picked up our kit after Christmas dinner, down to Brookwood, train into London. This was Christmas Day afternoon. Came off the train, got across to I forget now the tube station nearest to Regent's Park Barracks, which was the holding battalion in those days. And we were so fed up, the two of us, we sat down in the middle of the pavement outside the tube station on our kit bags and just sat there for about 10 minutes, thoroughly fed up with ourselves. Christmas Day, two young lads, you can imagine, on draft. And we made our way to Regent's Park Barracks, where on the gate was a young guardsman. The greeting we got was, what do you want? We've come to join a draft. Oh, well, there are just a few more up in what used to be the, I don't know what they used to call it. They used to have dances up there, upstairs. They're up there. Nobody wanted to really know us. We were nuisances on Christmas Day. We were put up there. We were eventually given tea in the canteen, mess room, whichever. And we went to bed on the floor of the dance hall on a couple of blankets. And we really didn't speak to anyone, hardly, except these other few odd chaps that were there, half a dozen. Then over the next few days, the draft that was to be built up with other personnel coming in from various places. My very close friend and pal, Ernie, was one of them. He came from, I believe, Chequers, I think, Prime Minister's residence.
This is Ernie Gallantry, your friend.
Ernie Gallantry, yes. Where I first met Ernie was in that room in Regent's Park Barracks. We're then not really getting much information at that time. As I say, it was the Christmas holiday. So after a few days, we decided to write out a pass, if we could possibly get home again for a weekend pass, which in my case, I don't know whether Ernie did the same in my case, I wrote two out, one for a long weekend, one for a short weekend, and we put them in. And come to Friday, we're sort of waiting with bated breath whether we're going to get this pass. And there was a sergeant major there, I believe his name was Nickel at the time, and eventually we're there, sat on the deck there in our bed spaces and what have you, with boots and gaiters on, dressed to get out of barracks quick, about 4 o'clock or after duties, whichever. And he came in and reeled off these passes, and I remember saying to Ernie at the time, how are you getting home? Have you got the money? So he said no, he was going to hit the Great North Road, the A1 later, and hitchhike it I had the 10 shillings, which was the return fare from King's Cross to Paragon in Hull at that time, so I could get the train. So we all legged it out of barracks, Ernie to the Great North Road, and me down to King's Cross. We met after the weekend, which was a long weekend. We got back Sunday night, and we met the next day, and I said to Ernie at the time, how did you get back? He said, the same way, hitchhiking, and I was back. That was our first meeting at Regent's Park Barracks, and from there the draft built up. We were there for probably 10 to 14 days all in all before we moved and marched off to Marylebone Station. This is where the laugh comes in. Everything was supposed to be in secret when drafts were moving. We're there with topies in their covers, slung on our bayonet frogs, with our SD caps in the cross belts of our big pack, and we're wearing side hats, they call them Glengarries, or what most of the army wore, which we, as guardsmen, we could never keep on if we're on the move, these little side hats. And we marched down the Marylebone Road from Regent's Park Barracks, 70 strong of a draft. The regimental band in the front of us was bigger than the draft. And they marched us down to Marylebone Station, where there were other troops joining, and we entrained there, for where at that time we didn't know. We soon found out when we got underway, because at that time station nameplates had been removed from every station. We were on a special track, which we later found out, a special track, and I recognised Leeds Station when we arrived. We pulled up in Leeds Station, and I recognised Leeds, though there was nothing to tell us that it was Leeds. And I remember I threw a letter I'd quickly written, the train, and I threw it out onto the platform in the envelope, obviously no stamp, addressed to home, and I threw it out. It was posted from Leeds and got back home, that letter. And we made our way, which took all that day and all that night, making our way up on the various route, which would be a special route for troop trains, of course, and couldn't recognise much on the way up. But we finally ended up in Glasgow, going through Glasgow the following morning at 6 o'clock. I can well remember, because the occupants of flats we passed on the rail line were hanging out of the windows at that time in the morning, knowing it was another trooper going up. And we ended up at, I forget which now, whether it was Gourock or Greenock, on the landing there. The trains in those days went right on to the quayside. Well, then we noticed this massive great ship out in the roads off there in the Clyde, and we were taken off in tenders and onto this massive liner, ending up with, I believe, 4,000 of us aboard this trooper. And incidentally, one of the first people I bumped into walking round the deck of the ship eventually was, to go back a little way, when I was travelling from Hull to London on the Christmas Eve day to join the draft, to go back to Pirbright, there was one other soldier on Doncaster Station. He boarded the train, and being the only bit of khaki he could see in the coach, he made for me and sat down with me. And he was a young chap out of the Queen's Royal Regiment. And the first one I bumped into aboard the Louis Pasteur was the ship we were on. I bumped into him, the lad I'd met at Doncaster Station. And we boarded the Louis Pasteur, which was the crack French liner of those days. She had been, when the war started, she was over in Canada. So the French-Canadian authorities took charge of her. And I'm given to understand she plied between Liverpool and Montreal with RAF personnel mainly. A lot of our RAF personnel went over there for training in Canada. And the people who were trained in Canada came back, and the Pasteur was doing this to and froing over the Atlantic until she arrived. She was needed for this trooping job, of which we went out on, the Louis Pasteur.
What were conditions like for you aboard ship?
Not really bad. We had the best conditions, as my old friend would agree with me, because we had what had been the sun deck, or the sports deck, aboard the Louis Pasteur, which they covered in, and it was steel shuttered down port and starboard, steel shuttered, and they turned it into bunk sections. They'd built bunks up on this part, and being on a small draft of 70, we were put up there along with a draft of the military police. There was a small draft of military police, and we had this sports deck, whereas so many of the others, there were so many decks in this ship, it was so big. The decks went down from, we were what they call sun deck, and then you started with A, B, C, D, E, F, G, all the way down below the waterline, and lots of them were in mess decks, sleeping on mess deck tables or in hammocks slung down below, whereas we were, the well-off ones, were in bunks up on that top deck. We were very lucky on that journey, very, very lucky. And incidentally, another little anecdote, whilst in that area, and many days after the ship's underway, and being a young signaller, and we also met up and palled up with another one on the draft who was a signaller. He is another close friend of mine and his wife, and has been all those years. He's a friend of Ernie's, we're all aware of him. We decided we would practice our Morse code, and me being a mouth organist, I could relate the Morse code on the top note of the mouth organ by just tonguing it, how it used to come out, and I would do this, and they would be taking this stuff down, a load of drivel, I might add. One night we're doing this, and where we were situated in this bunk section was just below the main bridge of the vessel. And one night the first officer came down into our section, and he said, "Who's using a Morse key?" "No one." And I just did this on the top. He said, "Picking it up in the bridge," he said, "it's a load of drivel." And I told him we were just practicing and training how it did. He said, "Carry on, boys, we'll ignore it." That's just one of the things that happened aboard there.
Did you run into the enemy aboard on this voyage?
Thank God, no, but we had one scare, one main scare, after leaving Cape Town, which we went into Cape Town, of course, and had a few days in Cape Town en route. Half the convoy went into Cape Town, half the convoy went into Durban. We then linked up afterwards, and we're making our way up between the mainland and Madagascar, which was known to be rife with Jap subs. And suddenly, before we get up into that area, the degaussing gear, which vessels were fitted with to ward off magnetic mines, I being a signaller, was always busy reading off the stuff that was going on between flagship, and the flagship was the Lord Strathaven at that time, and I was busy picking up good training and always intercepting messages. And I intercepted a message: proceed with all speed to Port Tewfik to our vessel, this message, because our degaussing gear went on the bum. It had gone. Something had happened. It wasn't working. So we were very vulnerable. And then we got this message from Strathaven: proceed with all possible speed. Well, if you think that we'd come on that convoy at a speed of 9 knots, which was the speed of the lowest merchantman or whoever, we had an escort of a Dutch Akak vessel most of the way, having had a destroyer earlier, which left us at one point, I can't remember where, somewhere towards Freetown, and we had this Dutch Akak vessel, was the only escort, and as I say, we'd been at a speed of 9 knots all the way from Glasgow. The ship we were on rolled and dipped and certainly around the Bay of Biscay as we're coming around that area. It was capable of 28 knots. And all of us, I said to the lads around me, I said, any minute now, this vessel will spring to life. And suddenly the engine stage surged and sprang into life. And we shot up the Red Sea on our own.
This is the Louis Pasteur.
This is the Louis Pasteur. And we shot up the Red Sea under our own steam at speed, at 20-odd knots. And she was, for the first time on the trip, she was smooth, whereas we'd rolled and wallowed for all those miles, for all those thousands of miles.
What happened to you once you got to Port Tewfik?
Can't quite remember. But of course, I think there was transport waiting for us there, and we were taken to Geneva on the just off the Suez Canal, Geneva, which was the base camp for all the infantry. There were different infantry units along the Suez Road there, Geneva, Fayed, Geneva, and it was just full of tended camps.
Is that where you joined the 3rd Battalion?
No, that was the base depot before we went to the 3rd Battalion. We were there for not so long, I think probably a week we were there. And then we were on our way by cattle truck up to the railhead at Fort Capuzzo in the desert.
What month is this, do you know?
February, 42, as I remember, early February. And the railhead only went as far as Capuzzo, and we tumbled out of there looking less like guardsmen than anything you could ever think of, because the cattle truck, there was some black substances on the floor of it, and at some point along the route, because of this, whatever it was, somebody had picked up some sheets of, I think it was roofing felt, on one of the stops along the line, and that turned out to have a cement cover to it. So by the time we dropped out of the cattle trucks, we looked less like guardsmen than anything you've ever seen. We were a bit black and white. We were in a bit of a mess when we arrived at the railhead, where there was transport from the battalion to meet us. And I think we got our first taste of the enemy in the desert on our way in those trucks, because some Jerry fighters came down at us, and the truck stopped, and we were ordered to jump out and scatter, which we did off the tail end of the trucks, and we scattered. That was our first taste of Messerschmitts having a go, and back in the trucks, and we arrived outside of Tobruk, as I remember, and there again we got out of trucks and sort of laid down on our chests while about 80 Stukas had to go to Brook whilst we were on our way to Brook Harbour. We eventually arrived at the battalion position, greeted by, which may be of interest, the platoon sergeant who met us later turned out to be Company Sergeant Major Peter Wright, VC. He earned a VC later, but he was the first sergeant that greeted us at the battalion, showed us how to dig, being rookies and young soldiers, and incidentally I was the youngest soldier in the 3rd Battalion at that time. I was the youngest soldier when I joined the 3rd Battalion, because they had been out there since 1936, and the nucleus of the battalion were old soldiers. They'd had drafts since then, but out of probably 850 battalion strength, three quarters were what I call old soldiers, against such as me being a young soldier.
What kind of a greeting did you get from the battalion?
We didn't see much of that. They were actually dug in on defensive positions when we joined them, a line just south of Tobruk. And we got there, sort of reached the battalion early evening, and were shown how to dig in immediately. We said, "Where do we sleep?" And Peter Wright, the sergeant, and said, "I'll show you." And he showed us how to dig our first trench we could sleep in that night, which Jeff Harms, naturally we palled up, two youngsters, Jeff Harms and myself, we dug this hole and we slept in that the first night. That was our initiation to being in the field with the battalion. And of course, we dug a bit more the next day, dug slit trenches and sort of did what everybody else was doing in this defensive position. I can't remember how long we were there, some time, but probably maybe a couple of months in that position. I can't quite remember now.
Could you live comfortably?
Oh yes, you lived as you were. I was supposed to have joined the signal platoon, but as was my pal Jeff, which we thought we were going.